From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Good evening, everybody. Well, good evening, everybody.
In 1998, art collector William Arnett saw a photograph of Annie Mae Young standing deep in Alabama with her great-granddaughter Shaquita. Behind them were two quilts, one with a strikingly bold medallion of yellow, brown, and red, surrounded by a sea of denim blue, set out to air on a woodpile. That striking quilt was the product of a generation's long tradition of quilting by the women of G's Bend, Alabama, a 5-by-7-mile peninsula on the Alabama River in the state's so-called Black Belt, southwest of Montgomery, southwest of Selma. The G's Bend community lived in relative isolation for decades, the descendants of slaves from the area's cotton plantations. They sewed their quilts from scraps of cloth, corduroy, denim work pants, feed sacks, brightly colored rags. They sewed them for warmth and with astonishing beauty. Now the quilts of their rich tradition are being hailed by the New York Times as some of the most miraculous works of modern art America has produced and are traveling to museums across the country. Tonight on Point, a celebration of the quilters of G's Bend. Joining me now in the studio are two of the G's Bend quilters, 69-year-old Mary Lee Bendolph and 75-year-old Annie Mae Young. An exhibition of 65 of the G's Bend quilts has been to New York, Milwaukee, Memphis, Houston, and Mobile. It is on display through the summer at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Mary Lee Bendolph and Annie Mae Young, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Just wonderful to have you. And aren't you getting around a lot these days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have been all over the place.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you traveled to each of the cities where the quilts have been exhibited?
Yes.
Which means you've been on the road, I'm guessing, like maybe, Mary Lee Bendolph, maybe never before in your life.
Never before in my life. Thank the Lord for it.
And riding a kind of magic quilt on that journey. Oh, God, that is great.
Enjoy every minute of it.
Oh, I guess you would. Annie Mae Young, it must have been really something when your photograph was spotted and suddenly you had people inquiring, what about this quilt? What's up? Do you have more? Do you remember the day when you kind of began to feel the interest rising in the quilts that you'd been making in G's Bend?
Well, I was 13 when I started making quilts. I started by my mother. My mother learned me how to make quilts. And I started quilting in the corner of her quilt. She didn't want me out in the middle of it because I didn't know how. And she didn't want it messed up. And she started me in the corner of her quilt.
Just the corner. Don't get out in the main body there too soon, Annie Mae.
Right. Don't get out in the main body in the middle. Right. Just in the corner. And that's why I learned how to quilt.
And from that, you kept going.
I kept going.
A lot of other people did as well. But there was a time, Mary Lee Bendolph, as I understand, where quilting had almost come to a standstill in G's Bend. It just, no one was quite in the mood anymore, and it hadn't made this big splash.
No, it hadn't made this big splash, and so the quilts had come to a halt. Well, the quilts weren't going no place, and nobody buying the quilts, and nobody selling no quilt, and then nobody had any real thing for no quilts at the time because they hadn't made enough to lay on the bed for the key wound.
Mm-hmm.
And by Bill found Annie Mae and her quilts somewhere in some place or another, and then he came down, and then that started the quilt back to moving again.
This is William Arnett, and we'll hear from him in just a few moments.
Yes.
And back it came, and now, like gangbusters, you all are kind of superstars on the museum circuit in the United States.
Yes.
It's a long way from G's Bend.
Long way.
Annie Mae Young, tell us about G's Bend. What kind of a... It's actually technically Boykin, Alabama, is the town and the community of G's Bend. What kind of a place is it?
Well, it's a nice community. Not too big a place, but it's nice. Nice community.
5 miles by 7 in this big bend in the Alabama River.
That's right.
Across the river from Camden.
Right.
And traditionally, Mary Lee Bendolph, this had gone back to a plantation formed sometime in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Where a lot of your ancestors had worked.
Yeah, they had worked there. Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many generations your family's lived in G's Bend?
I know 3. My grandmama on my daddy's side and my mama. I don't know about the other side, because
I just don't know them. I just know the grandparents. I don't know the great-grand, but I know he came from the great-grandparents to come to the parents. And so I don't know them. All I know the grandparents on my daddy's side. And I don't know my grandmama's side.
Mm-hmm. And Annie Mae Young, how about your family? How far back do you know their history in G's Bend?
Well, my father, he lived in G's Bend, and my mother. And I had a sister lived in G's Bend. She passed away. And so I got a lot of friends and relatives in G's Bend.
And what did you think when people got hold of these quilts that you began to make again and started pulling out of family closets and trunks and cedar chests, I imagine, and people just went over the moon about them? Did you know you were sitting on this kind of artistic treasure?
No, I had no idea I would be where I'm at this evening.
Now, I grew up in a quilting community in the Midwest. I remember old stories they used to tell about my forebears there, women walking home from the nearest neighbor, which would have been a mile or more away, late at night after quilting, holding a pine knot, burning pine knot up to keep the wolves back, but they loved quilting so much that they would go and do it, even though that was the journey home. But I have to say, the look of their quilts, I'm looking here at yours, it was different. It was much more geometric. These are fantastic kinds of designs, kind of freeform, looks to me like country jazz in a way. I don't know if you relate to that at all, Mary Bendel. How do you describe this style?
I describe the style because of, at the time, I wasn't so good at quilting. I just sit and tear my pieces up and sew them together because I didn't know how to make no fancy quilt. I could make a fancy quilt, but it take too long to make a fancy quilt. So I just take out and tear some pieces and sew them together. But this particular quilt was in the museum. I couldn't tear it loose. I had to cut it. My scissor wasn't too sharp. So, and then that throw them to becoming didn't come out so well. And it's one side upside down, crooked. But it came out to be beautiful. And its name, House Top.
And this is what we're looking at right here.
Yes.
With these bold colors, kind of orange and brown and black and almost a salmon or pink in there.
Right.
And definitely no effort here to make this absolutely symmetrical or absolutely even this way or that. But overall, this just pops. It just jumps up at you.
Yeah, it didn't come by me knowing what I was doing. It just came out of a match of the thing that I just wanted to put something together. And if that piece didn't fit, I put another piece there. I take that loose and put another piece there. And it came out to be beautiful, and I love it. It is beautiful.
And when you showed this to your friends or family, let's say, what was their response? Did they say, good Lord, that's going to hang on the wall in a museum in New York City?
No, they didn't know about that. They didn't know about that at the time because we didn't have no way of knowing anything that we'll be here today.
Yeah.
Didn't have no idea about Bill or Matt or neither one of them at that time. Mm. Only thing, we were just making quilts to keep our kids warm. Mm. And that was all the idea we had of making quilts, was to keep children warm. If I'd have had some idea that I could have to quit in the war, it'd have been beautiful than that.
It would have been something else. Annie Mae, what about you? You've, I'm sure, at this point seen in your life many quilts from all parts of the country, and you know the quilts from G's Bend. What do you think? How would you describe what sets them apart?
Well, I didn't have anything to make quilts out of at that time. Dress tails and pants legs and anything I can find. That's what I made quilts out. And I didn't use no pattern.
No pattern?
No pattern, just out my own.
Straight from the...
My head, just straight from my head, just make a quilt.
Right.
And I love that. All I want a quilt to go with my children to keep them warm. Mm. That's all I want. Just some so tough I can't tear it, I had to get the scissors and cut it.
Right.
But still, I got it together. And when I pieced up one, that made me pieced up another one. And the more I piece up, the more I want to piece up.
Now, I'm looking at this one here that you did in 1965. That is 40 years ago now. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
You call it bars. And it's this wonderful collection of colors, black and blue,
pink, white, a little stripe of green in there. But these are big, wide, bold bars. These are not the little triangles and familiar patterns of a lot of American quilting. And yet you looked at this and you said, this is right. This is just what I want to do. Or this is what the pieces
right.
I have will form.
They're already big.
Right.
I ain't got time no smaller.
Why make the pieces smaller? Let's use big bars.
Use big and while I hurry up and get my quilt. If I cut them small, it'll be a while trying to get the quilt big enough to go to bed.
Right.
So I just let it stay as it was.
Right.
And just held it up. How am I put this and this together? Let it stay just like it is. Why cut them small and they're already large?
God, we're talking about the greatest art of the century being held all over the country.
Yeah.
And you're saying, why'd you do it that way? Because it was easier
right,
that way.
Right, it was easier that way. To let it stay like big and you'll soon have a quilt.
Right.
Yeah. Cut them small, that'll be longer to get my quilt.
Still
hurry up and get a quilt and put those on children.
So you found what you could use, and there it is. And yet I look at this, and I can't help but seeing the kind of black and blue here, colors, of course, and that African-Americans have talked about more than once, and it's dominant in your quilt here. Mm-hmm. There's some music we're going to be hearing tonight as well out of G's Bend. This is a recording from 1941. We're going to hear more a little later in the hour, where Mary Lee Bendolf and others are singing, and quilting is going to be going on in our mind's eye here tonight as we look into the culture and quilts of G's Bend, Alabama. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There is
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the quilts and quilters of G's Bend, Alabama. They've become a kind of national phenomenon. The women of G's Bend have been making quilts for generations, and in the last few years, they have toured the nation with the most astonishing collection of eye-popping quilts. If you haven't seen them, you've really got to. You can see a collection of photographs of the quilts at our website, onpointradio.com. I'm joined tonight in the studio by Mary Lee Bendolf and Annie Mae Young, two of the quilters who have put out this prodigious stream of quilts that has turned heads right across the country and around the world. We're joined now as well in the studio by William Arnett. He's the collector who discovered the G's Bend quilters. He's head of the Tinwood Alliance Foundation in Atlanta, Georgia, that supports African-American vernacular art. William Arnett, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So you were the guy who saw this photograph of Annie Mae Young, who's with us today, and her granddaughter, Shaquita. And in the background, and I'm looking at the photo right now, there are a couple of quilts, big quilts spread over a good-sized wood pile, getting aired out, a little display going on here. You saw that and thought what?
I had never seen anything quite like it. I had spent the first 20 years of my life traveling all over the world, looking at documenting, collecting art literally on every continent, and had come back to this country and had some health problems and was sort of stuck at home, and one day decided to browse around. We all knew about the great music of the Southern South, but we hadn't seen much of the art. It had been hidden. And so I got fortunate enough to find some art, some artists, some kinds of things that were being done that people weren't terribly aware of, and that started me off collecting, documenting, and creating some books and exhibits. And ultimately, I got interested in quilts, which is one of the most widespread and important forms of African-American art. And I had found a few that were great, a few that pointed out what I was trying to show was that there was this great hidden tradition in the Black South that was probably going to change our art history. I saw the Annie Mae Young quilt, and it was even for a field of art that contained some surprising and unexpected masterpieces here and there and yonder. I had never seen a piece quite like her piece, so I thought, wherever she is, I need to try to find her. So I looked it up on the map and found out the county and the town and just went down there with one of my sons, Matt, who was very interested in this as well, and asked around until we found her.
We should do is a favor and give us a kind of a word picture, comparing these quilts to what most Americans will have in mind when they think of quilts. Of course, so many quilts are very detailed, highly geometric, small piece quilts out of a more European tradition or folk American tradition. These very bold, more free form, they draw these comparisons to oil painters, to Rothko and Matisse and Mondrian. Paint a word picture for us of what sets these apart.
You were off to a good start there. In fact, art critics have likened them to some of the great masterpieces of 20th century abstraction. It's not an accident, although the reasons for it are not what people expect. A lot of people look at things that come out of the Black South and say, well, look there, you know, they must have been looking at art books of modern art. The fact of the matter is that in the Black South, all the movements that you find in 20th century Western art existed long before the 20th century. There are a lot of reasons for that, but we won't go into it. But saying that these artists are doing things that look like what they do look like, they look a lot like Rothko and Matisse and Mondrian and a lot of other people, is like saying, well, Little Richard's copying Pat Boone. I mean, it's the other way around.
We don't think so. I think we have to go into why those fit together. I mean, does this go back to the kind of Picasso generation, their interest in artwork from Africa? Is there a connection right there?
Absolutely. You're right on it. The 20th century so-called modernists of Europe, first half of the century, were very, very aware of so-called primitive art, meaning African and pre-Columbian and Oceanic art that you would find in every big European city in museums that were then called ethnographic museums, mm-hmm. as if it were not art. Mm-hmm. But the artists themselves knew it, and they would go there and they would sketch pieces and they would come back. And that really is how modernism, it's how all the early isms of 20th century art, Cubism, Fauvism, Expressionism, they all came out of German and French and English and Italian artists seeing this so-called primitive art and creating a whole new aesthetic for Western civilization. Meanwhile, in America, the black artists who had originally come from Africa, but their culture had fused with what was here, the Native Americans and with white Americans, created or evolved into a culture all their own with an aesthetic that was very different from anything on earth. But it was kept relatively secret because it was not something that black slaves were supposed to do. In fact, black people, until fairly recently, weren't even supposed to be involved in the so-called visual arts. Mm. In the 19th, 18th, 17th century, it was even forbidden of the slaves to do anything that looked like an initiative toward establishing a cultural identity.
That kind of self-expression was taboo. Please, no. Mary Lee Bindoff, I think I've read of you telling the story, unless I've got the wrong quilter here, of a grandmother who would, when day was done, kind of hide out to do quilting.
It's Alonzi, not me.
Oh, okay. And can you share her story with us? This is another in your quilting circle.
I can share part of it with you. She said that when they was coming along, her grandmama, they was piecing quilts and staying up on a bush harp, and a white man come along and burn it up to keep them from making quilts and do.
And why would he do that?
They didn't want them to learn how to do anything.
Except pick the cotton and do the chores.
Do their chores. Mm-hmm. That's all they want. Mm-hmm. They didn't want them to learn how to write. They didn't want them to learn how to read. Mm-hmm. They didn't want them to learn how to make quilts. They just wanted everything for themselves, nothing for the colored people to mm-hmm. have. Mm-hmm. But out of all what they did, he couldn't stop them. Because when God in the plan, can't nobody stop what God got in the plan.
When God has a plan. And so her, was it grandmother or great-grandmother?
Great-grandmother.
As I recall her telling it, would kind of hide away after work, pull some brush over herself, get down in a private, some hide away.
Yeah, and hide out there. And that's why they peace quit there. Sometimes they find them and burn them up. Sometimes they hide their quills, keep them from burning it up. But you know, people's had sharp sense during the time. They'll go and seek it through the nighttime to try to burn it up.
Mm.
But yet and still, they couldn't burn it up the whole thing.
And they did it for very practical reasons, yeah. Annie Mae Young.
Right.
They needed the warmth of those quilts.
That's mm-hmm. right.
And as you say, the patterns are just what came naturally to them. It's from the pieces that they found and the way they just thought looked nice, thought yep. looked good.
Right.
So I'm curious, when you hear Mr. Arnett, William Arnett here, you know, putting this in the context of Picasso and Expressionism and Cubism and so on, how do you look at that? When you talk among yourselves about the excitement that you've created, do you say, these people are nuts going so crazy for these quilts we've had in the closet for 50 years? Mm-hmm. Or are you focused on what it is that has people so excited?
Yeah, I never thought he was crazy. Just something he seen and wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
He just liked it that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was lucky enough to find it, and he was glad to get that.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted that.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
Mary Lee Bendolph, your community has a single highway that comes into it, even now.
Right.
It had a ferry over to Camden.
Yeah.
Got cut off
in
the civil rights movement as a kind of a punishment of G's Bend.
Yeah, punishing us to keep us from coming to become a registered voter.
Right.
They took the ferry from now and then.
And of course, Camden was the place where everybody went to shop. It was
the
commercial
shop.
Center.
Then they punished their own themselves.
Because?
Tried to punish mm-hmm. us to keep us from becoming a registered voter.
Mm-hmm.
That did get next to me. I don't know why people could do peoples like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hurting their own self. You can't spite your face, cutting off your own nose. And I thought that was silly.
And now here we are today. You all are famous.
Right.
The Alabama Tourist Board brags about G's Bend and everything you produce there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You're a major attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Is Camden starting up the ferry again or talking about building a bridge over to where you are?
Mm-hmm. Trying to get the bridge, the boat to come back over there. But every time they get the boat to come there, something happened to it because it too much of sand in the river. You can't have that boat coming through there like that.
It's going to get stuck all the time.
Get stuck, that's right.
Mm.
They got to clean up the whole thing in order to get that ferry running back again.
Mm.
Because at first, it was just the river.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the dam water. All that pile up in there and trash coming running down the river, all that. Well, down on the dam part.
Mm.
They took the land, they bought the land from the peoples to put the dam down there in order to keep the water from flooding out the whole
mm-hmm.
land.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that it's going to be hard for the ferry to come back there.
Because the river's been changed.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, if they hadn't changed that, the it'll be easy to come. But I always said, I don't believe it coming again. It may. It'd be the best for them to put a bridge there instead of. It'll be hard for them to do that.
If you all stay on the path you're on, they may build a super highway.
Yeah.
Jeez,
and by with our quilts,
yeah.
At the time when we were piecing quilts
mm-hmm.
and quilting quilts, we had to beat our cotton. We first started to get the cotton from the gin house.
Mm-hmm.
And you beat all the trash out of it, dirt and things.
And the seeds and all that.
Some of the seeds.
Which is a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
To make it very smooth so it'd feel
yeah.
good in a quilt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And we lay the cotton out on the floor and beat it and beat it and beat it till we beat all the trash out of it.
Now, when would that have been? Like, how long ago?
That'd been around about in the 60s.
Because
mm-hmm. it just lately come for to have the coat to put in a quilt. And when we put our liner down, we take the cotton, we'll be done beating. Put it on the line. Then we beat it all out on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Then take the top and spread it over there. We had four frames during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we hooked them four frame up to the quilt.
The full frame, the standard yeah. sort of quilting thing where you
yeah.
stretch the cloth
uh-huh,
out.
And then had four nails up in the loft, had
mm-hmm.
string hanging down.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get rid of rise the quilt up so we could sit on the quilt. We get the string and wind it up there and wind it up on the other end, wind up on the either four end.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we can't finish the quilts out, so we wind it all up, so then we go to bed, and then the next morning
Bring
we let
down.
The quilt down
mm-hmm.
and then go back to quilt.
Work again.
Yeah. And then when we get all the way around the quilt, we get some old neckties or some string and tie a string in the corner, that in the string in the corner east end.
Mm-hmm.
That for there, so we can get in the middle of the quilt,
mm-hmm.
the finished quilt and not the middle of the quilt.
Now, if I understand correctly, you no longer go around to the cotton gin looking for that cotton.
No, the Walmart
in Selma.
Yeah, right.
For the batting.
Yes.
Times have changed a little bit.
Yeah,
there.
Times have changed.
But that's a lot easier than beating it on the floor.
Right,
and
much easier. Yeah, it
really is.
Oh, we used two horses. Now at that time, we didn't use no horses. Mm-hmm. We used a full frame, but now we use two horses and two frame. We hooked the quilts in. Mm. My daughter learned me that, to tack it in instead of hooking it in.
Right, right. Just a little simple. You've got only about 700 people living in Jeezbin. I mean, it's not a big community.
No.
It's not a rich community.
No.
40% of the people there, I read here, below the federal poverty line, 16.5% unemployment.
Right.
Your quilts must now be a significant piece of the economic pie in Jeezbin.
Yeah.
And Annie Mae Young?
Yeah,
they're important for
they're important.
I mean, these sell for $3,000 and right on up. People are wild about them.
Yeah.
Has it changed your lives?
It made me want to go to Peace and Quilts and Quilting now. I was doing a small amount of it, but I want to do a lot of it. Yeah, because it helped hope me. It helped my Bill coming into my house knocking late at night. I didn't want to let him in. And
Bill Arnett knocking at your door?
Yeah, he was knocking
at my... Was it late at night when he showed up?
Yeah, but late one night.
Did he scare the daylights out of
you? Yeah, he scared me. I didn't know him. He said, I don't know you. And we were scared of each other.
And what did he tell you?
He told me he seen the quilt. He seen it, and he know who snapped the picture, but I didn't know. But he said he know. And so, they said, I'm looking for Anna Mae Young. I said, well, this her. And then he told me he was looking for this quilt. If you still got this quilt, I see spread it on the woodpile, you and your granny. I said, I don't know. I burned up a lot of quilts last week. I might be done burning up.
He said,
let me come in. And I said, I'll tell you, boy, come back tomorrow.
When it's daytime.
In the daytime, while I can see. So he did come.
Yeah.
Under the mattress.
Yeah.
He come in, I let him. Ooh, he come so friendly and so lovely. I'm glad I didn't turn him away.
Yes, we're all glad.
I'm so glad I didn't turn him away.
Man.
He come to the house the next day, and we went in there, and he helped me look for it.
He
didn't stand back.
He got down on his knees.
He helped me. Right. He said, if I mess your bed up, tangle your bed up, I help you fix it.
Bill Arnett, you were determined.
Yeah.
Well, I knew what I was looking at.
He know what you're looking
at. I was trying to tell them, and they would.
The
quilt makers would say, "Well, this is just some old dirty thing I got, and it ain't nothing." And I'd say, "It's going to end up in a museum someday." And they said, "Oh, come on, this is old dirty trash, old junk."
When you see these quilts again, you ain't gonna know them.
How did you? Here you were, a white guy coming in from Atlanta. Off a photograph you saw, how did you go about the business of mining all these quilts from under all the beds and closets? And how did you get the word out that you wanted to know what was there?
I really didn't know there was so much. But then Mrs. Young said, well, I got a friend and I've got a cousin. And we just kept going deeper into it and met Mary Lee Bendoff and ultimately became friends with 50 or 60 different women in the area. And they, at first, obviously didn't trust me and shouldn't have, but eventually they realized that I had good intentions and we all became good friends, and it's really fortunate for all of us.
Mary Lee Bendoff, you've got a circle of about 50 quilters there now, I read anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You get together, you quilt, sometimes you sing, you've got the whole gamut of things going on, you've even got a CD out now.
Right.
And the church is a big part of kind of inspiration and beneficiary, I think, of some of the dollars this has brought in. You've got several churches there, but one of them is called the Church That Quilts Built, as I recall.
No, not the church. Quilt didn't build the church.
Well, you know. But is it a business now, or is it recreation? When you're quilting and singing, are you thinking of the cash register, or what?
Well, when I be quilting, I sing, pray, and just talk with the Lord, because I know that the Lord, the one who got us here today with Bill and Matt, are working with us. But just sit around the quilt and pray, sing, talk. Sometimes we have fun, eat. But I don't work with the whole group now like I did then because my mother got sick. and I had to stop and then join and take care of her. Then after that, my brother had an accident, and I had to wait on him. My sister had to stop working then and tend to my mama while I was tending to my brother, because they couldn't take that. He had been hurt in an accident, and every time they go there, they faint out. And they couldn't take it, so it just only me to stand there and take it.
A lot of people taking care of each other, and in the midst of it, quilts being made. Here's Mary Lee Bendoff in the background singing. We're talking about the quilts and quilters of G's Bend, Alabama. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And so
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the remarkable quilts and quilters of G's Bend, Alabama. Their work of kind of marvelous folk art quilts look to me like country jazz, just staring at them. So lively, so bold, all kinds of echoes of the modern art you'll see in museums around the world out of one of the poorest counties in the United States of America. Two of those quilters are with us. Mary Lee Bendoff is here with us tonight, 69-year-old G's Bend quilter, and Annie Mae Young, 75 years old, mother of 9 children. It was her quilt that first caught the attention of William Arnett in Atlanta and has whipped up a kind of national frenzy over these quilts. Mary Lee, Bill was saying earlier, there's this connection between all kinds of modern art that you'll see in the museums in New York, and an African connection, because so many European artists looked to Africa nearly a century ago now, got inspired there. Do you feel a connection through your ancestors to that same cultural inspiration? Do you consciously feel a kind of African-American-ness in your work? Do you think about it, or is it just what comes out of your fingers?
It's just what comes out of my finger. I do feel some time up there. Africa, America, because of what Alonzo talked about a whole lot. And I thought she was just joking about the thing, but I really found out it was true about the Africa, America. But mostly my work came out just the popping of my finger, just go and do. Tear my piece open and then just go piece queer. Yeah. But she was talking about what her grandparents did. And my grandparents taught me how to queer. My mama, Lise, she taught me how to make queer. My grandmama on my mama's side, she had passed before I was born. But my grandmama on my daddy's side was still alive, but she had slowed up making quilts because she was really old. Mm. And my mama, I thank the Lord that if she'd have been living today, she would just say, look what God had did for us to bring us up. Mm. But instead, they passed and gone.
Yeah.
And here we are here to receive the things what they have did back then with the one who built and there brought us up to the light to see.
Mm. Do you ever think, Annie Mae Young, about the fact that your forefathers and mothers, they were brought as slaves to pick this cotton in Alabama eventually?
That's right.
Now it's cotton that you've worked with that's made this kind of miracle happen.
That's right.
The same thing that turned them into slaves, that gave them some, for a while, very miserable lives, has been a blessing in your life.
Yeah, been a blessing in my life, with my mother and father helped on.
Bill Arnett, do you see a range or different threads even in this small community, or do you look at it as one great wave of quilts coming at you?
There are a lot of stylistic features that have come to be over a period of hundreds of years. The arts originally of black people in the South, while some of them are utilitarian like this, there was a real impulse to create things, to create a sort of identity. You'll find something like that among the Amish, who had very little of beauty, but that was dictated by their religion. But the black people is dictated by the slave masters. And so they created forms of communication and forms of entertainment and enjoyment in things that would seem innocuous to other people, like quilts, like funerary arts. And a whole spectrum evolved in the South that's just come into light And the world's going to be very surprised to find some of the greatest art of this country's history being made in the same kinds of communities as G's been, by people who are not looking at museums and don't need to look at Rauschenberg or Jasper Johns or Picasso. They got their own arts that this is just a little piece of, and there are many different stylistic qualities that come into play. Each one of these artists is an artist. When Annie Mae Young says, I just use the piece because it's there and I want to use the big one, and there's much more. She's playing with you.
Right.
Because we've had long conversations, and and she's thinking just like any other artist. You know,
how is this going to work with that? What's the
exactly,
color? What's the design that's coming up here?
And she doesn't just sew it together, because she's talked about, and all of the quilt makers have, how they'll lay things out and it doesn't quite look right. So they'll take a color out, a piece out, put another one in until they get it right. Mm-hmm. Just like an artist doing a painting will keep going until he's satisfied he's made the best effort.
You know, Annie Mae Young, from my own childhood, I know when women sit and do this together, the kind of calm that's in the room. I mean, a nice chatter that goes through the room, but there's a calm, too. I remember leaning up against my grandmother years ago and enjoying that as a boy.
Right.
Something very soothing about that work.
That's right. Like I was standing by my mother, she quilting, and then I'm standing up there leaning on her, looking at her, how she quilted. That made me want to quilt.
Mm-hmm.
I seen her doing. I want to do it too.
Even if she made you start at the corner,
right? And she did make me start at the corner. She made me messed up in the corner. She didn't want me out in the mill. That was all right. Yeah. I learned how right in that corner.
And Mary Lee, what about the men at home? What do they make of this?
They didn't even want the quilt hanging up in the house. It's just in their way. They don't want to walk around. They want to come straight on in. But when night come, the cover up. They want to quit the cover.
Sure.
They look at it on the bright side now, but they still don't want to quit in the house in the way, but they do look at it the bright side. They said, now that we go places, they don't really want us to go, some of them. Well, my husband did. Now I don't have to worry about that part there. Mm-hmm. So I just get up and go and enjoy going.
I wanted to ask you, does religion or spirit play a role in the design and creation of these quilts? Has it over the years?
It helps out a whole lot, because I'm in the church, and then I pay some money sometime in the church. I pay a little bit more than I usually pay.
Because you've got a little bit more coming in.
I got more coming in.
Mm-hmm. Annie Mae Young, what about, you've got a lot of children. You're not the only one with a number of children who's also a quilter. Are they picking this up?
Well, I have 9 head of children, 3 girls and 6 boys.
Mm-hmm.
They love to see me quilt, but they don't want to come home in that quilt hanging over the floor. My great-granddaughter, she's learning how to piece quilts and quilt.
Mm.
Yeah, my oldest daughter stay next door to me. Mm. She piece quilts and quilt.
Mm. And I wonder if you feel a new sense of pride when you see how this work has been received. Does it make you say, you know what, we're pretty special down here after all?
Yeah, it make me feel great, because I never thought that my quilt would hang up in no museum. Mm. I wasn't piecing and quilting them to hang up in the museum. Mm. I was just piecing and quilting them to put over my children. And just look where they hanging now in the museum. Mm. I didn't have no dreams of it, no thoughts of it.
Mm.
But that's what he had. And I thank God for it. Because God did it. God did it.
Bill Arnett, where do you see this going? When this generation passes on, will the quilting go on, or is this a moment in time?
There's some impetus because of what the women have done in other communities for people to go back to quilting, but it's not going to continue. A quilt is a hard thing to make, and it takes a long time, and you can run out to Walmart and buy something that'll keep you almost as warm for just a few dollars. So I think we're at the closing phase of quilt making, but there are many other kinds of arts that are out there too that are going to come to light because of the enormous success of this show, which is going to knock down some walls which are sort of barriers to other African American things out there. Well, now people realize, well, if we got a little village creating this much great American art, maybe there's something else. And indeed there is. So there's another a whole wave of things getting ready to come, including probably some other quilts.
Mary Lee Bendolph, I wonder if you feel a kind of justice in this, turning this cotton after all these years finally into something really good for G's Bend.
Yes. These quilts turning in help us to go forward in life, and it bringing our children, help them to go to school, and help them to start in college. Sometimes we give them a piece of money to start them over in college, and then we get a car, and it helped almost everybody in the, give them a big break.
I have to say, it is an absolutely dazzling display. It just, I can't take my eyes off these. They really are beautiful. And
yes,
Annie Mae Young, I'm glad you started at that corner and worked in toward the middle.
Yeah, I miss too.
I'm glad you got your hands on whatever scrap of cloth you can find and put it together with such a kind of genius here. It's wonderful talking with you today. Annie Mae Young
and
Mary Lee Bendall, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And William Arnett with the Tinwood Alliance Foundation in Atlanta. Thanks for finding all this, and thanks for bringing it to us.
All my pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. We're going to go out with a little more music. Here's, a group singing "O Lord Have Mercy." This is Jesse T. Petway with Isabel Petway Patton, Paulette Petway, and Jesse T. and Monroe Petway's Yard, recorded in 2002 out of G's Bend. See the quilts. They're at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston this summer, then moving back to Alabama, and finally next year in Atlanta. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, Lord, I need Thee. Oh, Lord, I need Thee.
Oh, in a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
Mark had expressed reservations in the past about revealing his identity and about whether his actions were appropriate for an FBI man. But as he recently told my mother, I guess people used to think Deep Throat was a criminal, but now they think he's a hero.
It's like having tried to protect something precious for all these years that you carry around, and for the first time it's not there to protect in your pocket anymore. It's a very strange feeling, but also relieved of an obligation.
No force in the world has done more to liberate people that they have never met than the men and women of the United States military. Indeed, that's why the recent allegation that the U.S. military is running a gulag at Guantanamo Bay is so reprehensible.
We're taking this step in the hope that this step will strengthen moderates on the Palestinian side and that we can move together in a process of reconciliation.
The fact that they called it a constitution actually raised this issue of, do we want a United States of Europe? And I think a lot of Europeans said, no, that's not what we want.
Chris understands how markets work. And he knows the need for transparency in financial exchanges and in the halls of business. He proved that he can bring people together of diverse opinions to get things done.
A neighbor called into our communication center and actually told the dispatcher, my neighbor's house is sliding down the hill. Instantly following that call by 0656, all the 911 lines were lit up.
Appoggiatura. APPOGGIATURA.
And there's a week. Mark Felt, the FBI's number two man, reveals himself as Deep Throat, the informant who helped bring down President Nixon. Robert Woodward and Carl Bernstein there confirm he was their man. The Bush administration reacts angrily to an Amnesty International report that condemned the U.S. for human rights abuses and called Guantanamo a gulag. Israel releases nearly 400 Palestinian prisoners in an effort to boost moderate Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Voters in France and the Netherlands reject the proposed EU constitution. Business-friendly California Congressman Christopher Cox is nominated to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission. 18 homes are destroyed in a landslide in Laguna Beach, California, and 13-year-old Anurag Kashyap wins this year's National Spelling Bee in Washington, D.C. Well done, Anurag. Jack Beattie, after all these years, Deep Throat front and center on the national stage, revealed.
revealed, and Pat Buchanan is saying, "See, I told you it wasn't me."
Wasn't me.
But you know, this raised the I word, the impeachment word, all over the news this week, including in the Boston Globe, but in a different connection. The day the Deep Throat story came out, Ralph Nader wrote in the Boston Globe, "The impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney under Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution should be part of mainstream political discourse." Well, let's make it part of discourse. Is there a case for their impeachment in connection with the Iraq War? And to look at the standard of history, the answer is a clear no. In the three cases of impeachment in our history, clearly politics drove each of them, and it wouldn't have happened if the... Essentially, impeachment is what... I mean, high crimes and misdemeanors are what a majority of the House says. But there's always been an element of illegality. Andrew Johnson was impeached for violating the Tenure of Office Act because he fired Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War. Now, that was an act just set up brazenly by the Congress, but he did violate it, and he was impeached for that.
Right behind Abraham Lincoln's death, President Nixon, yes, the one front and center this week, that
and,
history.
And he broke the law and even breached the Constitution by defying Congress over the 18-and-a-half-minute tape. And Bill Clinton, you know, there was a political will to impeach him, but he also broke the law or violated a standard that almost all Americans accept as valid. That is, that when you give sworn testimony, you tell the truth. He didn't. More than that, he looked at the camera and lied to the whole country, which is a political offense. But when you look at President Bush on our program, Graham Allison, the Clinton defense official, said he checked the boxes of legality. There was a UN resolution. It wasn't the one that, you know, it wasn't the second resolution,
right,
but it was one that made good behavior from Iraq the condition for not invading them.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't get the good behavior, as they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a congressional authorization of war, which is, you know, really more than Lyndon Johnson got. You know, this was directly from military force, not in the event we are attacked, as in the Tonkin Gulf resolution.
Of course, Ralph Nader says you impeach President Clinton over lying about an affair, and you don't President Bush for what he calls lying about going to war, different scale. Nevertheless, you say the boxes are checked. He's within the legal bounds.
Yeah, and the issue about lying for war, you know, people as diverse as John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, and even Juan Cole, the critic of the Iraq War, mm-hmm. accept that Bush did not lie, that he had false intelligence, inaccurate intelligence. However, the Downing Street memo published last month in Britain has raised new questions. In that memo, which is from a British defense official, he reports on his meeting in the summer of 2002 with our people over here, and he writes, "The intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy," end quote, to invade Iraq. The intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. But that's not saying that President Bush was saying fix them around the policy. There's nothing equivalent there to the 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the tape where the president said break the law. And in any case, this wouldn't be breaking the law.
Fixing intelligence around a case for war if it was known to be a false case?
Well, not a false case, because that's where Bill Clinton comes in as a backup. Clinton said, look, you're operating the same intelligence I have.
Right.
So maybe they were talking about fixing it in the sense of let's make it the best argument we can, but we really believe there are weapons of mass destruction there.
Well, so President Clinton not to face what Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton faced. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
All right, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.